You're listening to DTFHN for May 27, 2026. I'm your load-bearing host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue about whether those things should exist. Today's a day for realizing the old answers were never the only ones. Let's get into it. Every fantasy console you've heard of. Starts from the same premise. Strip away the complexity of modern hardware. Give people a tiny screen, a simple language, a set of constraints, and watch what they build. MiniMicro takes this idea and runs it through a slightly different filter. The core language here is MiniScript. A clean, minimal scripting language designed from the ground up for learning and tinkering, MiniMicro wraps it in a virtual machine that gives you a 960 by 640 pixel display. Tile maps, sprite sheets, sound, file I/O. The full fantasy computer experience. You can run it in a browser or download native builds. No install headaches, no dependency hell. Open a tab and start writing code. Now here's where I want to play devil's advocate for a moment. One of the comments asks why these learning environments always use indentation-based scoping instead of curly braces. The argument being that braces are more explicit, easier to explain, less error-prone, and honestly, there's a case for that. Indentation-based languages punish invisible mistakes. A wrong tab, a mixed space, and suddenly your program means something different than what you wrote. For a beginner, that's a genuinely confusing class of bug, but MiniScript actually uses end statement. And if, and for, and function, it's neither indentation scoped nor brace delimited. It chose the third path, the one that reads closest to how you describe the logic out loud. That's a real design decision, and it matters for the people this is aimed at. Kids, hobbyists, anyone whose first encounter with code shouldn't feel like deciphering ancient runes. The harder question is the one another commenter raised, free but not open source. And that's worth sitting with. MiniScript itself is open source. MIT licensed, available on GitHub, but MiniMicro, the fantasy computer built on top of it, appears to be free as in beer without the source available. The foundation is open. The house built on it is not. This is a pattern worth naming. An open language runtime with a closed application layer. It means you can learn MiniScript. You can extend it. You can embed it in your own projects. But if you want to fix a bug in MiniMicro itself, or fork it, or port it to hardware, you're asking permission. Not exercising a right. Another commenter asks, why not just buy a 3-euro Arduino and a tiny OLED screen? And that's a fair challenge. There's something irreplaceable about making a physical LED blink because of code you wrote. But that misses what fantasy computers actually solve. Zero friction on-ramp. No soldering. No driver issues. No waiting for a package to ship. You open a browser, and you're building. The real power of MiniMicro is that it exists at all. Someone cared enough about the learning experience to design a complete, coherent environment where the first 5 minutes are productive. That's builder culture in action. The open source question is real, and it limits the project's long-term reach. But the impulse behind it. Making programming accessible, joyful, immediate. Young Quajorda, that's exactly right. Now for something completely different. Story 2. The melancholy of slaying monsters. Bloodborne only shows you a boss monster's name when you attack it. That's a UI decision. Probably took someone 10 minutes to implement. But sit with it for a moment, because that one choice encodes an entire philosophy of interaction. The game assumes combat. The interface itself has no concept of coexistence. You literally cannot know what something is called until you've decided to destroy it. Jaroslav Slavzavelt, writing for MIT Press, traces the melancholy of monster slaying from Beowulf through Shadow of the Colossus to Undertale, and he builds a compelling literary genealogy, Tolkien rejecting martial heroism as its own end, Fumito Ueda designing colossi that feel more like cathedrals than enemies, Toby Fox building an entire combat system around the option to not use it. The through line is clear. Creators have been uncomfortable with the kill everything loop for decades. But here's the question. Nobody in game design discourse seems willing to ask directly. If slaying the monster has felt hollow since at least 2005, why is it still the default interaction model in almost every major release? 20 years of critical awareness, and the AAA industry still ships games where the primary verb is violence, and the primary progression mechanic is body count. Shadow of the Colossus made everyone feel something. Then they went back to making God of War sequels. The answer, of course, is architectural. Combat is a soft design problem. It scales. It fills hours. It justifies DLC. The entire economic structure of $60 games with $40 season passes depends on repeatable encounters with things that need killing. Empathy is hard to monetize. Wonder doesn't have a loot table. What's actually interesting is where the cracks appear. Undertale was built by one person. Shadow of the Colossus came from a small team with unusual creative autonomy. The games that interrogate the kill loop almost always come from outside the standard production pipeline. Smaller teams, weirder constraints, people who could afford to ask whether the monster needed to die because they weren't beholden to a quarterly earnings call that demanded engagement metrics. The gaming industry discovered the melancholy. Then it discovered you could package the melancholy as a narrative beat inside the same killing loop and sell both. Flesh documents the tension beautifully. What he doesn't quite say is that the tension is a feature, not a bug. For the business model anyway. The tools to build something different exist. They've existed for years. The question is whether the next generation of builders uses them, or just adds another elegiac cutscene before the next boss fight. Earlier we talked about systems that need to agree. Here's a story about how they do it. Even when most of them are offline. What if the reason distributed consensus requires a majority of nodes isn't because majorities are special, but because majorities are the laziest possible way to guarantee overlap? That's the question buried inside this beautiful piece of work from Padja. And to get there, you have to start with a card game designed for five-year-olds. Raft the consensus protocol running inside ETCD, CockroachDB, TyKV, half the infrastructure you touch every day has one core safety property. Any two quorums must share at least one node. That overlapping node carries forward the knowledge of what was already committed. In a five-node cluster, you need three nodes to agree on anything, because any two groups of three out of five must overlap. That's the whole trick. Majorities overlap by pigeonhole. It's elegant. It's also, when you squint at it, brute force. The card game spot, it has 55 cards, 8 symbols per card, drawn from 57 total. Any two cards share exactly one symbol. Try building that by hand. You will fail. The designers used finite projective planes, a combinatorial structure where any two lines intersect in exactly one point. Order n gives you n squared plus n plus 1 points, n plus 1 points per line, and the guarantee that every pair of lines crosses exactly once. Now map that onto consensus. Points are nodes. Lines are quorums. If your quorum structure is a finite projective plane, every pair of quorums overlaps in exactly one node, which is all Raft actually needs for correctness. And the quorums can be dramatically smaller than a majority. Order 7 give you 57 nodes with quorums of only 8. That's 8 out of 57 instead of 29 out of 57. you just cut your coordination overhead by 70%. The catch is real, and the author is honest about it. You can't just lose any arbitrary set of nodes anymore. Your failure tolerance is shaped by the geometry. If the wrong combination goes down, you're stuck. Majority quorums are robust precisely because they're unstructured. Any majority works. Projective plane quorums are fragile in exchange for being small. But strip away the practical constraints for a moment and sit with what this actually demonstrates. The majority quorum isn't a law of distributed systems. It's a default. The actual requirement is overlap, and overlap is a combinatorial property with multiple solutions. We picked the simplest one 40 years ago and stopped looking. The comments on this are genuinely good. Multiple people note that the real insight isn't the modification itself, but the reframing. Once you see that RAF's safety comes from intersection guarantees rather than majority arithmetic, the design space cracks open. The protocol you thought was fundamental turns out to be one point in a much larger space of possibility. This is first principles thinking applied to infrastructure everyone treats as settled. The tools exist. The math has been sitting in combinatorics textbooks and children's card games for decades. Sometimes, progress looks like solving a new problem. Sometimes, it looks like realizing the old solution was never the only one. And sometimes, the old solution wasn't just limiting pause, it was actively dangerous. Next up, a host header trick that slipped past Starlet's front door. I've spent enough hours debugging request routing to have a visceral reaction to this one. There's a class of bug that lives in the gap between what a server thinks it's processing and what it's actually processing. And CVE 2026-48710 is a textbook example. Beautiful, in the worst possible way. Here's the mechanics. Starlet, which underpins Fast API and by extension, a staggering number of Python web services, constructs its request URL by concatenating the HTTP host header with the request path. String concatenation. In 2026, an attacker sends a request to a protected endpoint but sets the host header to something like example.comclf. Groundkeeper excision of acts. And now the framework's internal representation of the URL says the path is -health, not protected. Any authentication middleware checking request.url.path instead of the actual routed path just got walked right past. This rhymes with something specific. In 2015, researchers documented request smuggling attacks against HTTP proxies where ambiguity between content, length, and transfer, more, uncog, bit, quote, end, pot. Same fundamental category. The system's model of the request diverges from reality, and that divergence becomes an attack surface. James Kettle's work at Portswigger made this a whole research discipline. What Starlet did here is the application layer version of the same sin. The engineering lesson one commenter nails perfectly is worth repeating. Never transform URIs by string manipulation. Never. The reason URI parsing libraries exist is precisely because the edge cases are adversarial. Every shortcut in URL handling is a future CVE. This isn't overcaution. This is learned wisdom. From decades of exactly this class of vulnerability. Showing up in exactly this pattern. What makes this particularly consequential is the blast radius. Fast API essentially is Starlet. The advisory rates at medium severity. But as several people point out, when you multiply a medium severity bypass by billions of installs and thousands of downstream projects that implement auth middleware trusting request.url.php .path. The aggregate exposure is enormous. And cloud security vulnerability catalogs haven't even picked it up yet. Which means automated scanning won't flag unpatched instances for days. The fix in Starlet 1.0.1 is straightforward. The fact that it was needed at all is humbling. String concatenation for security-critical URL construction, sitting in one of Python's most widely deployed web frameworks. Patch now. Then go audit every middleware in your stack that touches request.url instead of the router's resolved path. The gap between those two values is exactly where attackers live. From patching vulnerabilities to something completely different, pause, let's talk about what we choose to preserve. This one's genuinely lovely. One of the top comments on this piece links to a review that opens with a line so blunt it's almost a dare. Quote, "On the Road is a terrible book about terrible people." And then another commenter asks the question that's honestly more interesting. Why are Kerouac-like personalities so magnetic? Why does the freedom feel aspirational when the lifestyle, looked at clearly, is parasitic? Joyce Johnson's memoir answers that question without ever trying to. She describes a man who showed up to a blind date with a zippered sports bag containing a notebook and some Salvation Army clothes, moved into her apartment the next day, and left 6 weeks later on a freighter to Tangier. She knew he'd leave. She typed love above her name in letters anyway, then hesitated about whether she should have. That's the gravity of it. Kerouac wasn't selling freedom. He was living with so little friction that other people's lives been around him. What makes this piece remarkable as craft is Johnson's restraint. She's writing about a man who became a myth, and she refuses to participate in the mythology, the leather jacket he kept wearing after he got famous. She doesn't say it was cool. She says she wonders if it reminded him of the void, of the 600 men who died on the Dorchester, the red and black shirt he forgot to pack. She hung it in her closet and wondered if she'd see him again. These are the details that survive because someone decided to keep them. Not the legend, the shirt. The commoners who dismiss Kerouac as a phase for 20-year-old guys looking to seem literary are missing what Johnson actually wrote. This isn't hagiography, it's an inventory. What was in the bag? What got left behind? What a letter sounds like from 8 miles off the coast of Africa, when the person writing it has stopped drinking for the first time in years, and calls himself the healthy Jack you never knew. Pull this thread and you find something the Kerouac discourse almost never touches. The people who held still while he moved. Johnson had the apartment. Johnson kept the shirt. Johnson's memoir is the archive that outlasts the road trip. The canonical Kerouac lives in paperback myth. The real one lives in the details someone else bothered to preserve. That's what gets kept. Not the freedom. The things freedom leaves behind in someone else's closet. We talked earlier about tools reshaping how we work well. This next one's reshaping how I work. Let's get into Claude Code. A configuration directory with 13 files in it just mass-produced a senior engineer's institutional knowledge. That's the detail worth pausing on. Not the AI part, the directory structure. Someone at Anthropic published the internal layout of how Claude Code actually wants to be configured. And it reads like a Unix philosophy manifesto, dressed up as a getting started guide. There's a file called claude.md that loads every session. There's a settings.json for permissions and hooks. There's a skills folder, an agents folder, a rules folder with path gating so different instructions apply to different parts of your code base. Project scope commits to Git so your team shares it. Global scope lives in your home directory and describes you personally. The layering is deliberate. What's actually happening here is the tool is exposing its own control surface as plain text files in a directory you own. Rules are markdown. Agents are markdown. Skills are markdown with a slash command. Every piece of behavior that governs how this thing operates on your code is a file you can read, edit, version, and share. Boris Cherney from the Anthropic team says the single biggest lever is teaching Claude to verify its own work, and the mechanism for that is just writing the verification steps into a text file that persists across sessions. The comments are split in a revealing way. One person asks, what happens when Claude goes down for 8 hours and you need to take over the code base? Fair question, but the answer is already in the architecture. Claude.md is readable by humans. The rules folder is readable by humans. The skills are readable by humans. Everything that makes the agent effective is also documentation for the next person who opens the repo. That's not an accident. That's what happens when configuration is plain text in version control, instead of locked behind a dashboard somewhere. Another commenter points out you can just ask it to do things now and it works. True enough, but the gap between it works and it works reliably on my codebase with my constraints is exactly the gap these files fill. The casual user prompts and waits. The daily driver writes the guardrails once and lets them compound. Same tool, different ceiling. The ceiling is set by what you put in the directory. So we've talked about teaching machines to understand your code base, but what happens when humans can't even do that in a job interview? Let me make the case for the defense. A mental health startup serving at-risk youth needs people with genuine emotional depth. Resumes lie. Coding assessments measure syntax, not character. If your product is therapy access for vulnerable teenagers, maybe you should know whether your founding engineer has confronted real suffering, whether they can sit with discomfort, whether empathy is something they practice or just perform. A 90-minute conversation about hard days and personal challenges could surface exactly the kind of human signal that matters most in a 10-person company building something this sensitive. That's a reasonable argument, and it falls apart the moment you examine the power dynamic. In surgery, there's a principle called informed consent. Before a doctor opens you up, they explain what they're going to do, why, what the risks are, and what happens if you say no. The patient retains agency throughout. What happened in this interview was an emotional surgery performed without informed consent. The candidate was told to expect a non-traditional culture fit chat. What they got was a structured vulnerability extraction. Hardest day of your life, biggest challenges, deepest struggle. Conducted by someone who shared almost nothing of their own. The asymmetry is the wound. One person holds the scalpel. The other lies on the table hoping the operation goes well. And when the rejection email arrives 24 hours later, a single line, the patient discovers the surgery was exploratory. They were opened up, examined, and closed back up with nothing but a scar. The author names the exact feeling. It wasn't my skills they were rejecting. It was me. That distinction matters enormously. A failed coding assessment stings your pride. A failed vulnerability assessment stings your identity. And the cruelest part is that the interviewer almost certainly meant well. The format created the harm independent of intent. This is where it gets genuinely serious. Every hiring process is a system. Systems have failure modes. When your failure mode is making candidates feel emotionally exploited, you have an engineering problem, not a people problem. You redesign the system. Culture fit matters, full stop. But you can learn whether someone is kind, principled, and emotionally intelligent by watching how they talk about a technical decision they regret, how they describe a teammate they disagreed with, how they handle being wrong in real time. You don't need their trauma. You need their character. And character reveals itself in how people engage with the work, not in how much pain they're willing to display for a stranger holding a thumbs up or thumbs down. The mental health startup that built an interview process capable of damaging mental health. That irony doesn't need underlining. It means fixing. Moving on. In 1700 NIA, Western Union turned down Alexander Graham Bell's telephone patent for $100,000. Their reasoning was practical. They already had copper wire everywhere, and telegraph worked fine. They were wrong about the telephone, obviously, but they were accidentally right about something else. That copper kept finding new jobs for the next 150 years. The AC cables are the latest entry in copper's refusal to retire gracefully. Direct attach copper. Two modules, a fixed length of twin axe cable between them. No optics, no transceivers doing electrical to optical conversion and back again. Just electrons moving through metal the way they moved through metal since we figured out how to insulate wire. Take the fiber argument to its logical conclusion. Optical is faster, longer range, less interference. Follow that principle all the way, and you should run fiber from your top rack switch to the server 18 inches below it. Convert your electrical signal to light. Shoot it through glass across a distance shorter than your arm. Convert it back to electrical. The absurdity is the tell. For anything under 5 meters, which covers most connections inside a single rack. DAC just wins. Fewer failure points, lower latency, cheaper, and the spec is dead simple. No lasers to align, no optics to clean. The breakout cables are where it gets genuinely clever. A single QSFP 28 port carries 4 lanes. Split that into 4 separate SFP28 connections, and suddenly, one port serves 4 devices at 25 gig each. Pure copper multiplexing. There are NICs built specifically around this trick. 1 physical port, 4 logical interfaces, maximum density from minimum hardware. The trade-off is real. Above 100 gig, the shielding gets thicker. The cables get stiffer, and your cable management starts looking like industrial plumbing. Copper's reach shrinks as speed climbs. Fiber will own anything rack to rack and beyond. But inside the rack, copper endure, the oldest trick in networking. Run wire between 2 things. Still works. Sometimes the boring solution is the correct one. Western Union got a lot wrong, but they understood copper. If copper carries signals, what carries ideas? Let's pull this thread back to 15103, when mathematics started finding its own voice. Every programming language you've ever cursed at exists because someone mass-produced a notation, and the origin story of that notation is wilder than you'd expect. In Boing Tan's Spinchuzli, the first math textbook printed des nigh in England was written in Latin. Commercial arithmetic locked behind a language gate that kept it in the hands of clergy and aristocrats. By 1571, English had won. And that ship. Vernacular language replacing institutional Latin didn't just democratize math education. It may have caused the scientific revolution. Run this forward from the fundamental constraint. Mathematics in the 1500s had 2 problems. First, the people who could actually use it. Navigators, surveyors, builders, Shakespeare's rude mechanicals. Couldn't read Latin. Second, math didn't even have its own symbolic language yet. No equal sign, no standard notation. Everything written out in prose, in a language most practitioners couldn't access. Robert Ricord fixed both problems simultaneously. He wrote math textbooks in English, and in 1557 he invented the equal sign. Two parallel lines, because, as he put it, no two things can be more equal. That symbol didn't fully catch on until the next century, which is the comedy here. The most universal piece of mathematical notation took decades to propagate through the literature, because the literature itself was still figuring out what language to exist in. The parallel to open source is structural. Latin was the closed system. Gate-capped, institutional, requiring credentials to participate, English was the fork, digis, record, deep. These were people who took specialized knowledge and put it where others could reach it. The tools exist, the knowledge is available. That sentence has been true since 1571, and every time someone acts on it, the same thing happens. A surge of innovation from people who were previously locked out. The textbook was the original open source contribution. Ship the knowledge in a language people actually speak, and watch what they build with it. So, what happens when you apply that same principle to something everyone uses but nobody wants to run themselves? Oh. Three ingress shapes, five transports, one binary. That ratio tells you everything about what this project actually is. PostOrn is a single go binary that sits between every app you self-host and whatever transactional mail provider you already pay for. Your contact form, your Getia instance, your Ghost blog, your Mastodon server, they all need to send email. And right now, each one holds its own copy of your API key, runs its own retry logic, handles its own bounce quirks. The same outbound concern, duplicated 5, 6, 7 times across your stack. Let me play devil's advocate. Why not just configure each app individually? You set it up once and forget it. The answer is you don't forget it. You forget which app has which credentials when you rotate keys. You forget which one doesn't support your provider's API and needs an SMTP workaround. You forget that DigitalOcean and LightSail block outbound SMTP entirely, so half your stack is silently failing to send anything. The engineering choice worth admiring here is the convergence architecture. Three completely different ingress patterns. An HTML form post with honeypotty spam filtering. A JSON API with bearer auth and idempotent retries. And a full SMTP listener with start TLS and client certificates. All collapse into one internal message type that hits one outbound provider. That's a clean abstraction. The SMTP listener alone solves a real problem, because dozens of self-hosted apps only speak SMTP. And if your cloud host blocks port 25, those apps are dead without something like this in the middle. The comments are telling. Multiple people misread it as a mail server. It's not. It's the plumbing between your apps and someone else's mail server. And that's exactly the layer that was missing. The unsexy infrastructure that makes self-hosting actually work day to day. Single binary, single config file. That's how open source wins. By making the correct architecture the easiest one to deploy. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 27th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen 3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now, go question one assumption you've been carrying around too long. We'll see you back here tomorrow.